Any new people with us tonight, welcome. We always welcome guests at the Ottawa PC User Group meetings, and more than happy to have you join us as often as you like as a guest. However, if you'd like to join, it's only $20 a year, and there's a special on. So if you join before March 31st or by March 31st, you'll get 2 years for the price of one. So bargain of the year. All you have to do is go to our website and click on the Join or Renew link at the top, and it'll take you through to where you can join their happy little band. We are just coming up on it now, so I'll go ahead and I'm going to mute all. As always, everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves, and you can do so if you have a comment or a question, or you can use the chat window, and we'll be monitoring that. And then later on this evening, Alan will be posting on our website the contents of the deck tonight in PDF format, as well as the audio track and the contents of the chat window. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to take us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris, and welcome everyone. Eagle-eyed Stuart saw that we have some big numbers in our Q&A sessions, and this one I liked. We've covered more than 1,500 topics in the time we've been doing these Q&As. And we've still got more tonight, so there you go. Right, so we were going to start off with the answer to this question. Jeff Dubois has a presentation for us on Microsoft's OneDrive, but unfortunately he can't make it tonight, so we're going to have to postpone that one to a later date. However, we have another question that came in. Jan wants to know how she can transfer files from DVDs to digital files on the computer so that she can get rid of all the discs. So that's the question. I've never done this. I don't know whether Chris has, but
I haven't. I would ask Jen is on the call tonight, so I would like to ask Jen, is it specifically that it's movie DVDs or is it data DVDs that you're wanting to transfer?
It's movies, basically. Movies. It's you know, a TV series, whatever. The massive collection that you gather over 15 years of owning a DVD player kind of takes over, so.
Yeah, for sure. So I do know that VLC, which is the video lens something, it's normally for watching videos and music and some things like that. It can actually do it. I've seen it there. I've never actually done it myself, but if you use VLC, you could check that out. One thing is that as I understand it, most of the programs that are designed for ripping movies to MP4 or whatever format, they do have a problem if it's copyrighted material. So DVDs do have the ability to restrict copying, and so you may have a problem with some DVDs, but I don't have any details beyond that.
I did see something online about the VLC and that it does have a feature in it that could sort of bypass that copyright issue, and that's why I was sort of nervous that that was a legitimate program. But if you're saying
VLC is definitely a legitimate program. Okay. It's been around for many, many years, free program. Tom just posted into the chat that Handbrake is another program, so you can pick up the URL to that. I've heard of Handbrake before. I've never tried it.
I did try that one, and that was the one that wasn't letting me do anything because it was all copyrighted.
Okay. Jose Costa also says WinX DVD Ripper Platinum. So that's another one you could check out. But if you do know that VLC will do copyrighted discs and that, it definitely is a trustworthy program.
Okay, that makes me feel better about trying it out then.
Great.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much, everyone.
I just posted on the spot fix.
I just posted a link as to how to rip commercial DVDs to decrypt them with Handbrake. So Handbrake also gives you a lot of options as to what quality you want, and it also uses your GPU if you have one. So I think it's probably the best program best free program, at least, to rip DVDs.
How to geek that can't spell handbrake? The URL says how to use heartbreak.
Yeah, it does. That's funny.
And Tim says some DVDs have a copy that you should move to your computer. Some kind of key, I guess. And Bill says he's used handbrake in the past. It's very good and easy to use. So.
And Stu Bruce has also makemkv.com, another one. So lots of options there for you, Jen.
Report back. Tell us what works.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, everybody.
Okay. Next up, we have a loony link from Tom. This is the doors open for music at South Minster. So I guess this is a lunchtime concert series, which presumably you can attend in person. But in particular, this is a YouTube channel which posts all the different events. So if you're interested in that kind of thing, Tom's recommending DOMS as a possibility.
Yes, and I'd like to talk a little bit about it. South Minster Church is opposite the Sunnyside Library, and they have this at noon every Wednesday. Amazingly, this is all done with several smartphones, and the guy in the back room who I think is watching them all on a big monitor or several monitors, and he does all this all the cutting and live, and there's about, I don't know, four or five different smartphones that he sets up. It's different for each setup because they do jazz, they do classical, they do Christmas music, they do a whole variety of things using local musicians. And try it out. There's just one today. In fact, Tondre Fidel, I think that was called Conversations. And the last one, the one today was Conversations. And that actually ran late. So it was actually live, but it was like live at 4 p.m. instead of noon. But they're all there. You can go back for about three seasons, and there's probably, 90 to 100 or more different concerts that are done by local musicians of all kinds. So if you're interested in music, you can actually attend in person for, it's a free, it's a, if you want to give a donation, then that's welcome. But so you can attend for free, or you can watch it live, or you can watch it on the YouTube channel.
Hey, thanks, Tom. And the next loony link is also from Tom, but Chris put this slide together, so I'll let him chat about it.
Yeah, so a pitch here for the member forum as well. So this is something that Tom posted at the member forum. And so if anybody who doesn't know about it, it's a 24/7 avenue for discussing anything to do computer related. And if you want to join up, there's instructions on our website on how to do so, or you can just send me an email and I can sign you up. So this was one I found it kind of interesting. This is talking with docs. So it's a couple of surgeons that are members of the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons in Canada, and they have a wide-ranging number of or types of topics that they have. So their aim is to make medicine accessible to the masses, and they do have a little bit of a bend towards the orthopedic treatments, but they have things on all kinds of health-related topics. And they are really funny to listen to. And it has, a lot of different stuff on it. And here's some of the topics that have been posted in the past. So mistakes people make about knee replacements, inflammatory foods, what you should avoid on that, whether daily aspirins are actually good or bad for you, top 10 mistakes for on how you measure your own blood pressure and so forth. They're very short, but I found them really useful. So thanks very much to Tom for posting that into the member forum. And again, if you wanted to join the member forum, just let me know and I'll sign you up.
And the next one is yours too, Chris.
Yep. Oh, yeah, okay. So, yes. Okay. DeepSeek R1 has been in the news quite a bit lately. It's in the last couple of weeks. It's a Chinese firm has put this together, and It's been, you know, touted as being the next great advancement in AI technology, and mostly in that they can do it with a very small fraction of the resources that the big players like Microsoft and OpenAI and Google and so forth are actually expending to make AI available to the masses. So Dave Plummer, he has a channel on YouTube, and he's a really interesting guy. Sometimes gets really deep in the woods, but he often explains things at a level that even I can understand. So he is a retired Microsoft software engineer from quite a ways back, but he just does this as a hobby now. And so he had this one thing just recently on how DeepSeek R1 is shaking up the world of AI. And get it. Yeah. So the highlights of his video is why it's such a big deal, and he does think it's a big deal, how it actually works and how it's different than people like OpenAI and so forth, what's new in it, and some of the implications that are coming from DeepSeek R1. So it's an interesting video. If you have interest in AI in general, and if you've been at all confused, certainly by DeepSeek R1 and what it really means, I think Dave Plummer does a really, really good explanation of it. And I'll paste that chat, link into the chat.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. And now Bob Harris has a little story for us, and you should be able to change the slides, Bob.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you very much. Thank you, folks. Good day, folks. I'd like you to join me on an adventure tonight, an adventure that involves ink, frustration, and a few questionable decisions. There we go. I bought my inkjet printer in 2016, over 8 years ago. It's an Epson tank printer. I print a lot of stuff. I go through a lot of paper. I use a lot of cardstock. But my ink seems to literally, I spend nothing on ink at all. The ink just literally seems to last forever, like literally years. And for many years, everything worked just totally fine. And then I had a presentation, and I wanted to print some hard copy notes. And that's when I was greeted with the E11 code. So I thought I knew my printer inside and out. Turns out I had no clue that it even had ink pads. It said, ink pad needs service. Contact Epson. Turn off. This code meant my ink pads were waste. Ink pads were full, and Epson wanted me to call them. Yeah, right. Full. Anyway, I did some research. I figure I'm a very handy fellow, but not quite as handy as this guy. I don't really have three hands. But anyway. I had to make a decision here, and so I did some research. I learned removing the ink pads was like defusing a bomb. You have to remove the ink pad holder without tilting the printer, and you have to remove the ink pad holder from underneath the printer without tilting it. So I put the printer over the edge of my desk, looking upward. There's screws to remove and little clips inside there. I finally got it out without tilting it, and I wasn't covered in ink either. So I discovered it was possible to clean the ink pads. And then all you have to do is put them back in again. So I got some gloves, went to the kitchen sink. And there's the little ink pads and the little holder we removed from the, there had a little tool here. And I used water to wash the ink pads. All of the ink came out very easily and readily. It was nothing to it. So you may ask, what do you do with wet ink pads? You put them on the floor register to dry. That'll dry them right perfectly for you. And then, after 24 hours, they were all dry. I popped them back into the ink pad holder, only to discover they had shrunk. You can see the original one on the left-hand side, they were all fluffy and filled the whole area fully, and after, they're all flopping around in there. This is not good. We need a new plan now. So, off to Amazon. I ordered two sets of ink pads, $21.99, and they arrived very early the next morning. Picture on the doorstep. There it is. Perfect fit. I'd already cleaned the ink pad holder. I had one set left over, and they popped them right inside there. They're the old ones on the right. And this kit came with a little bag for the old ink pads. Mine were already cleaned up anyway. And even had little gloves in there too. And I have one more set for future use. So, now the big moment here. I put it all back together. I felt very proud of myself. I reassembled it, but it still wouldn't work. It turns out you have to reset a counter. Oh, so anyway, we went forward and I found a utility called WIC Reset Utility, WIC.support. You download the software to reset the counter before the printer will work. Pro tip, you have to read the instructions, download the software. Anyway, pop that on, and lo and behold, I learned printers have hidden parts. Do it yourself, might save some money. Don't bother washing out the old ink pads, just buy new ones, and don't forget to reset the counter so it'll work. Thank you, everybody.
Very good. Thanks very much. And Stu says you found a new reason to buy or think about buying a laser printer.
Wasn't that Allison? Allison is wondering if trusty old Canon MX320 has ink pads. I guess you'll find out if you ever get an error code coming up on your printer. Oh, Ed says all printers have ink pads. Good job.
Yeah, they're never in the reviews or the advertisements, but it wasn't bad for 8 years. I printed a lot, and I'll have another, 8 years. I'm lucky anyway.
Well, you got another 16 years. You got two sets?
That's right, too, yes.
Good luck trying to find drivers for Windows 21 or something like that.
Okay, next up is Chris has a share for us.
Yeah, this is kind of neat. I just came across this the other day, Microsoft Edge, and this is only available in really up-to-date versions of Microsoft Edge. They have a scareware blocker. Now, I'll preface this by saying that a good number of the people on the call tonight, this will not be relevant to you. If anybody is technically knowledgeable, you probably wouldn't have to worry about this at all. Oh, I don't have the URL. I'll get the URL later into the chat. So scareware scams is defined by Microsoft as being a tech support scam. So these are the ones that typically they come up full screen on your while you're browsing the web or whatever, and they trick you or try to trick you into thinking that your system is in danger, it's infected, or some problems with it, and you have to call the tech support number in order to fix things up. And, of course, if you do that, they try to get you to load up some software that will give them remote access to your computer, and they can do whatever they want. So very bad thing to have happen to you if you fall for it. One of the things that's interesting about these sort of scams is that, for the most part, they come and go in hours. So your anti-malware software that's on your computer is not likely to detect it, because by the time the anti-malware companies actually can get out descriptions of it, or even if it's a lookup every time you go to a website or whatever, they may not have it listed before it's actually gone. So you can't count on anti-malware software doing any protection on this one. So they have a new scareware blocker. It's in preview. I've been trying it, and it doesn't seem to do any bad things. They say it uses machine learning, one of the buzzwords of the day, to recognize telltale signs of scareware scams. Now, I think in its current incarnation, the one thing that it is recognizing is when something tries to go full screen on your computer from the web or something like that. That seems to be what's triggering it now, but there may be other things that it actually looks for as well, or they might be developing this in the future to look for additional telltale signs of scareware scams. So to enable it, it will be disabled by default. So to enable it, you go to in Edge, you go to the Meatball menu in the top right-hand corner. Then you go to Settings, Privacy, Search and Services, Security. And then if you see Scareware Blocker, you can turn it on. If you don't see it, you're just not up to date with the absolute latest version of Edge, apparently. And then here's an example of what it looks like when you actually have Scareware blocked. So it is something that in this case here, it's trying to go full page, and before it actually allows it to go full screen, where somebody might freak out and not realize they can't get out of it, or you know, you just hit escape a couple of times and you will get out of it. But if you don't know that, you just think that you have to respond to this Scareware message. And so what they'll do is they'll show you a screenshot of what it's trying to do, and they'll give you a warning. They'll let you go to it, which is a good thing, because if it's got any false positives and you know it's safe to go to, you could actually let it happen. But otherwise, it isn't going into that full screen mode, and you can just close it down. So I think it's a good thing. What it's really good for is if you have people that are less technically adept and knowledgeable about things that may fall for these scareware scams that pop up. If you can get this blocker turned on their copy of Edge, then it might save them and save you getting that call from the other person saying, oh, please help me fix my computer, or please fix my computer for me. So just a handy little tip. I don't think it'll do anything bad. Thanks, Tom, for putting in the chat the URL for that. That's all I have on that one.
Okay, and the next one is yours too, Chris.
Oh, I'm up a lot here tonight. Yeah, this was something Jeff Dubois actually had, and he had a question. So when you're on Google Maps, very often what you'll see are county road numbers or regional road numbers instead of common street names. So here's an example here where we see, you know, it's regional road 17 and 16 and 63. And if you were to look at this, you might be at a bit of a loss as to where that actually is located. Now, you can zoom in on things, and if you zoom in, eventually you do see the street name. So here we see it's actually Clyde Avenue and so forth. So, but that time, by that time, you zoomed in so much on the map, you may have lost the context about where you actually are. So, Jeff in particular found this really annoying. And his question is there a way to tell Google Maps to display the real road names rather than regional road numbers? And I don't know the answer to that. I do know that my Garmin GPS in my car does the same thing, that it often will display regional road numbers, like instead of Blair Road, it'll have County Road or whatever it is on there. So if anybody has any idea, then it would be great to if you could pipe up.
There's nothing in the chat on that question, so while people are thinking about it, there are a couple of questions on your Scareware story.
Yeah, I see that. Karen wants to know if it's just in Edge. It's Edge for now. I wouldn't be surprised if other browsers pick it up as well. As far as I know, it's only available in Edge. And Timothy asks why it's not enabled by default. And I think that's because it's in preview mode right now. So they're still looking at it as, you know, maybe it's going to do some things that will cause extra confusion or something like that. So as they get feedback from people who turn it on, and once they get enough people saying that, yes, it's a good thing and it's not doing anything bad, I suspect that they will actually enable it by default.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And on the maps issue, I've read online that Bing Maps is somewhat better than Google Maps in this respect, but I don't think it's perfect either. If anybody has any bright ideas or a different mapping system that works better, put it in the chat or send us an email and we'll follow it up later on. Okay, in the meantime, let's move on to a share that I have for everyone on passkeys. I've been reading a bit about passkeys and trying to figure out what they do and if they're going to be useful. And the basic idea is that you should be able to use passkeys to log on to servers and not have to remember passwords. And the password is all automatically, the password is automatically built into the way that passkeys work essentially. And what it's doing is it's using encryption and it's using what's known as asymmetric encryption. And the other way that's referred to sometimes is public key, private key pairs. So when you set up passkeys, you're setting it up from a device, your computer or your phone or whatever, and with a specific server, let's say Google, for example. So your Google account, instead of having to enter your user ID and your password, in theory, you can do it using passkeys without using this password. So basically, we're talking about authentication. So we need a user ID because clearly the server has to know who it is that's trying to log on. So you have to enter something, and the user ID is the initial piece of data that the server wants. Once you've done that, it knows who you are, and it knows the device you're using. So it sends you a challenge, and the challenge is encrypted using your public key. Public key means that it's available to anybody, and when you set up the public key pair, you've shared the public key with the server, but you have not shared the private key. It's private. It's yours. It's on your system and your system only. So you get this challenge your device, your computer receives this challenge, which is encrypted using your public key. And in the background, your computer decodes the challenge and then encodes the response using your private key. And then the server sits at the other end. Now it's got some encoding from you, encryption from you. It decrypts that response using, again, your public key. And it knows now who you are, and it verifies that you are in fact you, and so it logs you on. And all that is basically done in the background. So the question is, how does all this work? And what do these key pairs do for you? And it's a mathematical trick, essentially, or a mathematical operation. You have these two keys. If you encrypt something with your private key, the only key in the world that can decrypt that is your public key, and vice versa. If somebody who has the public key encrypts something and sends you the encrypted message, only you, who's holding your private key, can decrypt that message. So it's a secure, encrypted communication system using these two keys. The beauty is that the public key you can give away to anybody because nobody can generate the private key. Only you hold the private key and you have the key to the castle. You're the only person that can really do stuff. All right, so this is Gary Sims from Android Authority, and Gary explains. It's a pretty old video, but it's actually quite good in terms of giving you at least the basis of the mathematical operations and how the public key, private key pair work. And there's a YouTube video, and there's also an associated web page if you'd rather read text and see static pictures. But I highly recommend the video. And everything is based on RSA, right? RSA is an algorithm. It's the Rivest Shamir Adelman algorithm. And these three mathematicians are the guys that basically put this thing together. And it's all based on modulus. And modulus is a mathematical operation. And it's pretty simple, but it's really, It's really interesting. Modulus is just the remainder when you divide two integers. So if you divide one integer into the other, you get a number. It goes in so many times, some whole number of times, and there might be something left over. So, for example, if you do 11 modulus 5, that operation gives you a 1. And the reason for that is because 5 will be divided into 11 twice, but now you have a remainder of 1, right? So 2 fives are 10, and you have a remainder of 1. And by the same token, if you do 12 mod 5, then you get a remainder of 2 because 2 fives are 10, and you've got 2 left over, and et cetera, et cetera. So eventually you get to 15 mod 5 is 0 because 5 goes into 15 exactly 3 times, so there is no remainder. And then the interesting bit, 16 mod 5 is now 1 again because 5 goes into 16 3 times, 3 fives are 15, and you've got 1 left over. And you've got other numbers that do that. For example, so you've got these two numbers here which give you the same remainder, and 21 and 26 and all kinds of other numbers will generate a remainder of 1. So modulus is a kind of interesting function because you can get the same number, but that you can't go backwards. If I tell you that the answer is 1, you can't tell me, even if you know that the public key is 5, you can't tell me what my starting number was. You can't generate that 11 or 16 or 21. Right? So we call modulus a one-way function. You can calculate the remainder, but you can't go backwards and find out where you started from. And this is the whole basis of this encryption. If you think of it in terms of the 5 is essentially the public key, and the 1 is the encrypted number, the ciphertext, if you like. So we're starting off with, in cryptography terms, we're starting off with plain text, a number, 16. We have a public key, which is 5, and we have this function, this modulus function, which calculates the ciphertext, which is 1. And even though I tell you that the answer is 1, you can't go backwards and tell me, did I use 16 or did I use 21? So that's the beauty of RSA. And if you really want to dig into the weeds a little bit in terms of the mathematics, and this guy has a whole bunch of videos on the topic, and he has a really good example of how RSA works. Very simple numbers, but he goes through it step by step, and you can see exactly how things work. And the main thing to realize is that you're not dealing with public keys like number 5. You might have 300 digits in your prime number as your public key. Using these huge prime numbers, and that's why prime numbers are so important, you get these huge prime numbers, and there's basically no way to go backwards and find out how anything works. I like this tagline on his video here. If you can't explain it to a 6-year-old, you don't understand it yourself, Albert Einstein. I'm not sure how many 6-year-olds are going to understand modulus arithmetic and RSA key encryption, but for the rest of us, this is a really good video in terms of how things work. All right, so if we ignore the weeds and the details of the mathematics, let's just think about logging onto Google. So we talk to Google and we set up this public private key passkey system, and Google has our public key, and we have both our public key, obviously. We also have our private key, but only us have the private key, right? The red key. So we can give the green key away. People can encode messages for us, but only we can decrypt those messages because we have the private key, the red key. All right, so let's log on to Google. So we have to tell it, okay, here I am. I'm logging on using my Google account user ID, which is my email address. And so Google says, okay, I'm going to issue you a challenge. I'm thinking of this number, 495184. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to encrypt that number with your public key. So now I've got some encrypted text, and I'm going to send you that text. And I'm going to say, what is this number? So this is a challenge, right? He's thought of a number. He's encrypted it using my public key. He's sending it to my computer, and now I have to do something with it. I have to respond. But if you remember, anything that's encrypted with my public key can only be decrypted by my private key. So my laptop is going to dig out my private key, and it's going to decrypt the encrypted number, and it's going to find out that it was 495184. And now what it does is it decides, okay, now we're going to encrypt that with my private key, right? So I've got a new encrypted number now. I send that off to Google. I say, okay, here's your number. Here's your encrypted number. I've encrypted that with my private key, the red key. The only key that can decrypt it is the green key, the public key. Well, it turns out, to remember, Mr. Google has my public key, so he can decrypt that encrypted number, and he gets 495184. And he says to himself, hey, I started with 495184, and you've just responded to my challenge with 495184. So you must be Alan, and you're okay. We're going to log you on. So that's basically how it works. And remember, you're not doing this encryption, decryption stuff. It's all happening in the background. The computers are basically talking to each other. And that's why you don't have to remember any passwords, because it's dealing with everything using these pass keys. So in theory, that's a much simpler system. It's also supposed to be much more secure than anything that anybody's thought of so far. So let's try and see if we can use it with Mr. Google, right? And again, here's a video if you want to know a bit about passkeys and how servers log on and all that good stuff. This is Leo Notenbaum, the Ask Leo guy. Really good video, very simple explanation of how passkeys work. And he talks about logging on to Google. And what you do is you have to go into your account, and you have to set up the passkeys. So if you go to your account and you go to the security tab over here on the left-hand side, and you scroll down, you'll find this button here, which is passkeys and security keys. And when you click on that, you'll be able to set up passkeys. Except all I see is a passkey can't be created on this device. Make sure that the operating system is up to date. It is. Make sure your screen lock is enabled. It is. Make sure Bluetooth is enabled. It is. And that you're using a supported browser like Chrome. I am. So the question is, why can't you create a passkey? I don't know. That doesn't really help me. So I say, well, the other people that deal with passkeys is Mr. Microsoft. So maybe we can go to Mr. Microsoft, and we can create a passkey in my Microsoft account. So again, sign into the Microsoft account, go to advanced security options, and when you do that, you'll find that passkeys are a new way to sign in. You can use your face, which is the Windows Hello feature. If you have a webcam and Windows Hello software, you can use fingerprint if you have a fingerprint scanner on your device. You can use a personal identification number, a PIN, or if you have a hard security key like a YubiKey or something like that, then you can use all of the above to log into your device using passkeys. So I click on the next, and my only problem is I don't have Windows Hello. I don't have a fingerprint scanner. I don't have a security key, a hard key like a YubiKey. So I was going to use a PIN. I'm pretty happy. I can remember, a six-digit PIN or something. But I can write it on a sticky note on my computer. That's pretty secure. I think I could remember a pin. But the problem is when I try to go further, the only things that are available to me is Windows Hello, which I don't have, a security key, which I don't have, a phone or a tablet. I'm trying to use my laptop, or a security key, which I don't have. And where did the pin go? I wanted the pin, people. So, I don't know. I can't use, no, I'm using Windows 10. Tom's asking if I'm using Windows 11. I'm using Windows 10, Tom. My computers won't upgrade to Windows 11. So I'm trying to get onto Google. I'm trying to get onto Microsoft. I can't do it. So I go to Perplexity and I say, why can't I store a passkey on my Windows 10 computer? You gave me all these promises and now you say I can't do it. And Tom may be very right. It says, you cannot store a passkey on your Windows 10 computer because 10 lacks full passkey support, only Windows 11 offers functionality, doesn't have the required web authorization API version, lacks a trusted platform module, which is necessary, which mine doesn't have. And there are all kinds of reasons why, although I can use passkeys, I can't use passkeys because my Windows 10 computer actually doesn't support all the things that apparently are necessary. So if anybody's interested in using passkeys and has all the right hardware, it looks like really neat technology. And one of these days, I'm sure I'll be able to try it out, but not for the moment. Okay, that's my little rant about...
Yeah, it's a good rant, Alan. And just before we move on, going back to the Google Maps, Steve Parker commented on it that if you're actually using the Google Maps API generating custom maps, you can actually do it using a JSON script to do it. So he pasted in what you could actually do on that front, but most people are not actually using the APIs to generate custom maps. So I don't think it'll help Jeff out. But anybody who does use the APIs could be an interesting workaround to be able to get more details on street names and things like that.
Okay, good. Thanks very much, Steve, for that. And moving along, we have another problem, but this time it's from Chris.
Yes. Yeah, this was kind of an interesting one. It sort of solved itself for me, but this may be of interest to other people that are interested in hibernation modes in particular on their computer. So I bought a new laptop. I called it Enceladus. And so anybody who cares, it's an Asus ProArt PX13. So a nice little computer. And I went in and I configured the power settings for when I'm on battery. I give a lot of presentations, and so I wanted specific settings that when I'm in battery mode while I'm at a library branch giving a presentation. So you go to System, and under the Settings app, you go to System, Power and Battery, Sleep, Screen Sleep and Hibernate Timeouts, and I set the turn off my screen after 20 minutes of inactivity, and then make my device sleep after 30 minutes of inactivity. And I figured that was pretty good settings for what I wanted. Now, note that there's no option in that dialog box to set a hibernation mode at all. So just keep that in mind. So as we go further onto this, even though I had no option for hibernation, I did have it that Enceladus would turn off the screen after 20 minutes of inactivity, and it would go to sleep after 30 minutes of inactivity. But an interesting thing was if I left it in sleep mode, after a couple of hours, it actually went into hibernation. And I couldn't figure out why it was actually deciding to go into hibernation, and I wanted to figure out where I could set that so that I could adjust it or see what the actual setting was at least. So there are benefits of being in hibernation where you're using no power at all. So hibernation writes the current memory state to a disk file, and then it shuts the computer completely down. So there's that benefit of using no power, but recovery from a sleep mode just takes a couple of seconds at most, and recovery from hibernation takes about 15 seconds. So another disadvantage of hibernation is that it may shorten the life of a solid-state drive because it's writing a huge amount of data to the hibernation file every time it goes into hibernation mode. So if you want to control hibernation, it can't be done in the Settings app, but it can be done under Control Panel. So you go to Control Panel, Power Options, Change Plan Settings. Whoops, excuse me, wrong direction, there we go. And then once you get into the Change Plan Settings, you can change Advanced Power Settings. And then you can see where you can finally expand a section for sleep, and you can choose Hibernate After, and then you can set the time for hibernation while on battery. Only, I didn't have an option for Hibernate After in mind. This was what I was actually looking for or hoping for, was that I would have another set of instructions or callouts in there where I could set Hibernate After and I could set a specific time period. It didn't show up in Power Options on my computer. So Perplexity AI to the rescue, maybe. So if you have no option for Hibernate After in the sleep section of the Change Advanced Power Settings, so that's where I was, they suggest you have a number of things you can do to resolve the issues. And I'm not going to go through all of these in detail. So the first one is just making sure that Hibernate is enabled. That's fine. It obviously was enabled on my computer because it did go into hibernation mode after about 2 hours. And then there's a whole bunch of things you can do with registry settings and so forth, and changing the hibernation type using Power or CFG, things like that. Yeah, they suggest that you might want to update your BIOS and power management drivers, and that's just a catch-all. If things are not working, make sure your computer's up to date.
Chris, but can you just stop for a second? Josh says that your slides aren't showing. Is anybody else seeing that problem?
I'm seeing them.
I'm seeing them.
Yeah,
that's really your problem.
Okay, Jess.
What slide is Chris on now? Maybe he can say to.
I'm saying I'm Perplexity AI to the rescue is the title.
Oh, I see that. I see that.
Yep. Okay, Jess. I think you're just having a problem. Okay, so an interesting thing on this Perplexity AI response was a concluding statement, and it said, if these steps don't resolve the issue, it's possible your specific device or Windows configuration doesn't support Hibernate After option. So my initial thought, after I read all of those instructions, with that as a conclusion, I said, what the fudge? I might do all of those, and I still won't have the option to configure Hibernate After? I wasn't all that impressed with that idea. So, what did I do? I did some more reading. So, Microsoft has a web page on their official word when it comes to hibernation, and I'm pasting that into the chat. So, adaptive hibernation is apparently what it is I'm really looking for. There's lots of details in there, including how to use Power CFG at the command line. It's really a good, interesting article for anybody who's dealing with sleep modes and hibernation and things like that. It's really quite good. So they said there are several settings that can affect how a computer automatically hibernates. And this turns out to be what was really happening on my computer. So there is a setting in there called Standby Budget Percent. And it defines the amount the battery can drain while it's in sleep mode before it will automatically go into hibernation mode. And the default value for that is 5%. So if the battery drops by 5%, while it's in sleep mode, it would automatically go into hibernation mode. And there's a couple of other things that manage how often it checks for the battery level and some things like that. So there are a few other values that you can actually adjust as well. So I tested that on Enceladus, and sure enough, after my computer had hibernated, I checked and the battery level had dropped by 5% from when it went into sleep mode. So it looked like that was the setting that was actually happening, and it was doing it at a 5% drop in battery. So do I really need to configure Hibernate after a period of time? Because I looked at it, I said, well, with my current configuration, while I'm at battery, the screen turns off after 20 minutes of inactivity, and I can configure that no problem if I wanted something different. It goes into sleep mode after 30 minutes of inactivity, and I can configure that. And then the last one, which I would have to actually change the configuration using Power CFG, computer hibernates when the battery level drops by 5%. So that's configurable through the Power CFG command line utility. But for Enceladus, that turned out to usually be about 2 hours. So my computer will drop its battery level by about 5% after about 2 hours of being in sleep mode. And, you know, I thought, that's not too bad. So I can sleep the computer for a couple of hours without it going into hibernation, and it'll come back to life really quickly. The battery should never drop to zero, because if it goes, if it drops by 5%, which I think is a reasonable amount that I can let it drop while in sleep mode, then Enceladus is going to hibernate for me. And that actually sounds pretty good to me. So it turns out that the default values work pretty well for me, but if I did want to change it, or if anybody on the call tonight wants to change this automatic hibernation, you can actually do it relatively easily just using the PowerCFG command. So I would really recommend that the main article in this one is, I'll just jump back, this one here. So, and I've pasted that into the chat. So if you really want to be able to play around with that, take a look at that article. It goes into quite a good detail about how to configure automatic hibernation. And I think that's all I had on that one.
Okay, there's nothing in the chat. So the next one is yours, Chukas.
Holy cow. You're getting sick of listening to me. This was, I got a good chuckle out of this one. It turns out the OPCAG is doing spectacularly well. I stumbled across this as I was looking up some information on the web and trying some random searches and things like that. And I stumbled across this information about the Ottawa PC User Group. And it's at zoominfo.com. And I don't have it already. I'll paste it in later on. So it turns out that we have a revenue of $11.9 million. And we have 70 employees, according to this site. So some of the latest hires and their positions. So these newcomers to the group that just joined last year, Chris Taylor as president and Alan German as treasurer, just joined in 2024. And our main competition, I didn't realize this, the Ottawa Fountain Bend Society is our top competition, but I checked, and it's okay because they meet on Tuesday evenings. So that massive overlap we have of people that are members of the Ottawa PC User Group and members of the Ottawa Fountain Pen Society, no problem. We meet on different nights, so there's no conflicts there. But we are also in competition with the North York Astronomical Association, the Ontario Electrical League, I didn't know about them, and the Malaya Association of Ottawa, which is an Indian group or something like that. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Some of the technologies that we use apparently is WooCommerce. Not exactly sure what that is. We do certainly use WordPress and PHP. And the Google Font API is apparently another top technology that we use here. So just to let everybody know that you have no fears about how long we're going to last. Our competition doesn't seem to be a problem for us. We have revenues that are through the roof. And you can count on our longevity, I guess. That's all I had on that one.
Yeah, I'm really happy that we meet on Wednesdays because my Tuesdays are busy. Stu says he wants to request a raise to cover the cost of living and entertainment expenses. Consider your stipend doubled, Stu.
Oh, come on, triple.
Okay, well, I don't know how it happened, but for the first time in as long as I can remember, we're into the last 10. We have 9 minutes to go before the witching hour of 8:30. So if anybody has any other questions or comments on what we've discussed or things that they would like to share, Bill thinks we should use our newfound wealth to fly out of town members to the barbecue. Good luck on that one, Bill.
But do they have planes from Shawinigan to Ottawa?
Yeah, that's London, Ontario. And yes, they do have planes from London, Ontario to Ottawa.
Because I don't see anything yet in the chat.
Because oh. The cat, no.
There's one.
Yeah. So Karen is asking, can Tom talk more about the Windows 11 rumblings for older machines? Tom, what do you have to say on that?
Well, in fact, you can. There are a variety of techniques to install Windows 11 on machines that don't match the requirements of Microsoft. And Microsoft is letting them exist. And that's basically the basis for the things. But Microsoft will refuse to update them. So you probably can find a way to install Windows 11 on any kind of more modern computer. I think you probably have to have a TPM, but I'm not even sure of that.
I think you can bypass that too. Yeah.
So, and I think that's the source of the rumblings, is that Microsoft isn't really cutting you off at the knees if you do install Windows 11 on a slightly older machine.
Yeah, the suggestion is that they're relaxing their hardware requirements, but that's actually not true, is it?
That's why it's a rumbling rather than an actual fact, because they're not completely clobbering Windows 11 things or actually even cutting off the way for people to install Windows 11 on older machines. It still works on older machines, and in fact, I think there are a lot of machines that it would still work on, including the security aspects, but that Microsoft isn't allowing because I don't know why, because they want to sell more hardware. I don't know. Kind of weird. I guess they want to move people into the 21st century.
Yeah, personally, I find it unconscionable that they're cutting off people with older hardware that way. Now, in a related note, I guess, to that is the whole idea is if you have older hardware, it's obviously you are running Windows 10 at the current time. And so it really comes down to that idea. I don't think there's anybody who's screaming to go to Windows 11. You know, it's more a matter of the end of life coming up on us for Windows 10. And so Microsoft has stated that they will do at least a 1 year where you can pay for security updates on Windows 10 beyond the end of life. And they've only stated a 1 year period, and it's pretty expensive. I forget what the dollar value was for it, but it was quite a bit of money. And for those who are interested, Alan has a presentation coming up, Windows 10 End of Life, at the Ottawa Public Library on Zoom on Thursday, February 13th at 2 p.m. So that's next Thursday. And so if you're interested in trying to extend beyond the end of life, Alan has some ideas certainly in that presentation about it. But, yeah, in terms of being able to install Windows 11 on unsupported hardware, I don't think anything has really changed recently on that. And I've seen a couple of clickbait articles that seem to allude to the idea that they were lowering the standards, and I don't think that's really the case.
How to Buy a PC presentation, which is also next week, I think, Chris.
Yeah, next Wednesday I have the How to Buy a PC if you're interested in moving on. And Steve just pasted in, the price is going to be $30 for the first year of Windows 10 support. So it's pretty expensive. Steve says doubles every year, but I thought that was only for commercial that they did that. I thought on the consumer side they were only stating 1 year was all they were promising, and the commercial side they could double every year if a company wanted that.
Only for 3 years.
Yeah, that's right. Only for 3 years. It's a pretty ugly situation that Microsoft has chosen to take and inflicting this on their customers. I'm not all that happy with it, even though I don't have any Windows 10 computers still kicking around here. But I don't think it's very fair way of them treating their customers.
There is another alternative, and that's that Zero Patch is offering Windows 11 updates for years. They've been offering them for the other red circled or unsupported Windows, Windows 8 and its varieties, okay. And Windows 7 and backwards. So I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure I think Windows is charging a couple of hundred bucks maybe more in Canadian money, especially these days.
Yeah.
But I think zero patch is more like 100 to cover Windows, old editions of Windows. It's also a way for you to actually run, like, I don't know how far back they go. I'd have to take a look. But I think they go back to Windows 7. They may, who knows, maybe they go back to Windows 2000. Who knows? And those are security updates only, of course.
Yeah.
Windows extended support is $30 for 1 year, and zero pass is €29 per year.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so there's an interesting question here from Elizabeth. She can
comment about
Facebook,
this.
But she cannot access.
Oh, just a second, on. Alan.
There was someone that had a question. They had their hand upstairs, I think it is.
Yep. I replaced both PCs in the house with laptops, but those two PCs had their motherboards were equipped with slots to add a TPM. Did anybody ever hear about that? After I discovered that in the book, I checked on Amazon. There's a whole bunch of TPMs that are being sold on Amazon, and you can just buy one between $25 and $40, add it to your motherboard, and you're equipped with a TPM. But I gave one to my dad, and I sold the other one, so I don't know. I haven't experimented with that. We're on laptops now.
Yeah, good to know about it, though, yeah. Thanks, Serge.
All right.
Yeah, so Elizabeth had this question of she can access Facebook, but she cannot access Facebook Marketplace. Access is blocked to Marketplace. Has anybody seen anything, know anything about that? And just a comment to Steve's thing here, $30 for the first year of Windows 10 doubles every year. No, it's Windows 10, the non-commercial version is $30 for 1 year only. It's the commercial version that doubles up every year. And I forget where it starts at, but as Tom said, it gets into the hundreds of dollars eventually. But it's only good for 3 years.
One off-the-wall news is that Bill Gates has written the first volume of his autobiography, which really covers his youth and the start of Microsoft, which people may be interested. The name of the book is called Source Code, and there are a variety of he's been doing interviews on different podcasts and video and TV and radio shows that people may be interested in looking at. Recent interview with the Washington Post. I forget which podcast I heard it on, but that's just happened the last few days.
And all his proceeds are going to charity as well, which is nice. I forget which it is. I think it's health-related things, which is what his interests really lie in. And he said proceeds as opposed to profits, which is interesting. So all proceeds are apparently going to charity.
I think proceeds is after all expenses. So it's the same as profits.
Oh, really? Okay, I thought it was basically income, whatever it was charged for the thing. What do I know?
Okay, well, let's wrap up. As you know, for members, we have our one-on-one remote assistance program, and we're always interested in finding people who've got some kind of expertise that you'd like to share with other members. So if you have any interest in volunteering to join our group, expert panel, as it were, just send us an email and we'll be happy to sign you up. If you're not a member of OPCUG, Chris mentioned we have a special, and the special is if you give us $20 for 1 year membership before March the 31st, we will give you a second year membership at no extra cost. So this is buy 1 year's membership and get a second membership year absolutely free. However, if you are a member, don't bother renewing. Don't send us any money, because the board has decided to extend everybody's membership current membership by an additional year at no cost. So no renewal.
And because we have revenues of $12 million, I mean, yeah.
That's right. So for the foreseeable future, until Zoom changes its mind. OPL, we have lots of presentations coming up. Chris mentioned mine on February 13th, but Linda has a session, a travel thing on Ireland and Scotland.
That's actually been cancelled.
That's the one that's been cancelled?
Yeah.
Oh. All right, ignore that one. you can go listen to mine, Windows 10 End of Life. It's a Zoom presentation, but you have to register for it because this is the library, it's not us. And Chris has got a number coming up. They're all on the link here. Now, the one I picked out was this PC Tips. It's basically a compilation of all the tips he's been putting into the newsletter over the last quite a long time. And Windows 10 End of Life. So my solution is to move to Linux and dual boot Windows. So only use Windows when you need to and use Linux for the rest of your usage. And Chris's solution, no, not really. Chris is going to tell you how to, what you need to think about when you want to buy a new PC. So this will be our next monthly meeting. It'll be next week, February 12th. And everything you need to know about buying a PC. In March, our meeting right now is scheduled to be smartphone apps. So I say right now because I've got, I think, three apps promised, and that's not enough to keep an hour and a half going. So if you want to showcase your app, let me know, because after next week, if I don't get lots and lots of smartphone apps to talk about, we're going to have to switch up and do something slightly different. So we'll talk about that after March, after February the 12th or 13th or whatever it is. Yeah, so next week there's no Q&A session, but Chris will be doing his monthly meeting via PC. So our next Q&A will be the 19th, so you have 2 weeks to think about all the things we've talked about and find some more questions, find topics that you'd like to share, find answers to Facebook Marketplace and Google Maps and all those kind of good things. And we'll see you next week for buying PCs.
Thanks for coming, folks. We'll see you next week.